KPCW News Time is now 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's find out what we've got in store for our weather this weekend. Maybe he'll come up with some snow. We have Cedric Hayes with the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast as we head into a busy holiday weekend. Your Friday forecast will feature mostly cloudy skies to start. Watch out for some patchy, dense fog, but we'll see partly cloudy skies by your Friday afternoon. Temperatures warming into the low 40s in the Park City area. We'll see those highs climbing into the upper 40s to near 50 in the Heber Valley. It's going to be an overall warm weekend heading your way. Your Valentine's Day, it starts off on a cold note with temperatures in the teens in the Heber Valley. We'll see those temperatures kicking off into the low to mid 20s in the Park City area. As we go throughout your Valentine's Day, it's going to be a warm afternoon. Temperatures climbing into the mid 40s for highs for us in Park City. And we'll see those highs rebounding back into the low 50s in the Heber Valley. So after a kind of a frigid start, we quickly warm up throughout the day. Your Valentine's Day evening, temperatures will fall from the 40s down into the upper 30s in Park City. And for your evening plans in the Heber Valley, temperatures fall from the 50s through the 40s, but overall somewhat comfortable. Your Sunday will feature a mix of sun and clouds as we see more clouds in the afternoon hours. Temperatures start off in the upper 20s, and we'll see those highs in the upper 40s in Park City with highs in the mid 50s in the Heber Valley. Heading into next week, we've got some big changes that will be moving in. Your Monday will feature increasing clouds. We'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies. Highs will warm near 50 degrees in Park City with highs in the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. But don't let the warmth fool you. Big changes are on the way. A strong cold front works its way through, bringing a good chance of accumulating snow on your Tuesday to the Park City area. We'll see a chance of a rain-snow mix in the Heber Valley on your Tuesday, but it gets colder and it stays active through most of next week, at least through the middle and end of next week. And that means we're looking at several opportunities for seeing snow. Snow will actually be likely with some accumulations, likely both for Park City and the Heber Valley as we get into your Wednesday. And we'll continue that chance of snow even into your Thursday with temperatures not getting above freezing in Park City and highs in the upper 30s in the Heber Valley. That's your latest forecast from the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Now let's see what we can expect this weekend in the backcountry. On the phone, I've got Drew with the Utah Avalanche Center. Good morning, Drew.
Good morning. This is in fact Greg and not Drew.
Greg.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, Drew and I are swapping some roles today. But boy, the snow the past few days sure brought a smile to people's faces. It's been a long time in coming, and we've had decent snowfall, up to about a foot in places. It was heavy, dense snow. So this actually contained quite a bit of water weight, a disproportionate amount of water weight with respect to snow. So we're seeing settled snow totals now of about 8 to 12 inches in the Cottonwoods along the Park City ridgeline. And that long period of high pressure, weeks literally, from early January for about 4 or 5 weeks, we saw little to almost no snow, but we had clear skies. And what it did is it weakened the existing snow surface. So it created this widespread layer of weak faceted snow, some surface hoar, on mid and upper elevation slopes, particularly those northerly facing. Southerly facing slopes, a lot of that stuff melted out, or there's just a sun crust, but it's on those shady slopes where that faceted snow exists. And then it got covered over the past couple days. So we saw some avalanches over the past few days as well, both human-triggered avalanches in the backcountry, avalanche activity from the resorts. Not that widespread. We're continuing to go with a moderate avalanche danger. This is going to be on the north-facing slopes, north half of the compass, I should say, northwest through northeast, where there's a moderate danger. This means human-triggered avalanches are possible. What makes it tricky is that because the recent storm snow has fallen on top of that weak layer, you may not see all these signs of instability right away. And these avalanches can be triggered remotely, that is, you know, from a distance, or they could be triggered from below. So it's a moderate danger, which means human-triggered avalanches are possible, but it's a tricky moderate. So asking people just to definitely pay attention to the snowpack structure. If you see some stronger snow, a stronger slab on top of that weaker faceted snow, and you're on a slope steeper than 30 degrees, it's possible you can trigger an avalanche. Avalanches will be maybe up to 18 inches deep in places. So Definitely keep that in mind as you're planning your travels this weekend. And yeah, you just heard Cedric. We're expecting a return to real winter later next week. So fingers crossed for that.
Well, thanks, Greg. Have a good weekend. You're going to get out there this weekend? Bye-bye. The Olympics have occupied a lot of our time and energy this week. And coming in from Councilman Bill Sirocco has been attending the Winter Olympics. But I suspect he has his eyes on more than the competition. He joins us by Zoom this morning. Morning, Bill.
Morning, Roger. It's actually late afternoon here in Cortina, and I had a wonderful day skiing today.
Oh, so you actually got to go out and ski yourself. Did you do the slalom or the moguls this morning?
Well, I wouldn't call it either one of those. I did clock in at 53 miles per hour for my high, but it didn't look anything remotely like a slalom, moguls, or downhill.
So, Bill, tell us a little bit about, I assume you're not there just for the skiing. Tell us a little bit about what you hope to learn for Park City by attending these games.
Yeah, no, look, this is a great place to be, you know, regardless of whether the Olympics are here or not. So it's, you know, I'm fortunate to be here and be able to make this trip. But for me, making this trip was about, you know, seeing how the Italians executed. And basically, the biggest question was coming into this games, you know, way in advance, the Italians decided that they were going to spread the games out across a large part of the northern part of the country. And to me, you know, I had some concerns, but they weren't my games to plan or have any input on. So I wanted to see how that worked for the Italians.
And did it work? I mean, do you think they were able to successfully create sort of a unified Olympic Games across multiple areas of competition?
Yes, and. What I will say is I spent the first three or four nights in Bormio, Italy, which is a town in the Italian Alps, which hosts a World Cup skiing event every year in December, that it's famous for, the Stelvio slope there. And, you know, my 3 days in Bormio, it was very, very quiet. It did not feel like it. It did not feel like it had the energy of an Olympic Games. So the Super G, which was 2 days ago, I think February 11th was the men's Super G race. And, you know, Team USA was fortunate that Ryan Cochran Siegel won a silver medal in that race. And they gathered all the Americans in the grandstand after, like, at the end of the medal ceremony, because they wanted to shoot some video of us. And there was about 12 or 13 of us. I'm sure there are many, 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 many more Americans over here in Italy for these Olympics. But the spread out nature of the games, I think, is taking a little bit of the excitement away.
Have you also spent any time in Milan?
Briefly, on my way in, I flew into Milan's Linate airport, which is, it's like the LaGuardia airport for Milan. It's the smaller, more domestically focused airport. It's literally adjacent to the, you know, center city area. Whereas Malpensa, the main long distance international airport into Milan, is about an hour away to the northwest. At the airport, when I came in late Monday evening. It was 8 o'clock at night, and the airport was fairly empty. There was only one out of eight baggage carousels was running with bags. That was the one that my flight just came in on. No like Olympic contingent greeting anyone. Now this is, you know, on February 9th. So we're like three days into the games. But still, I remember in Paris in 2024, arriving in Paris 3 days before the games, I mean, you get in the airport, you couldn't walk three steps without running into an Olympic volunteer. So it felt different.
Now, you sort of talked about sort of a lack of that overall spirit surrounding the location. Is that also true when you get to Cortina? Is it a little more dynamic, a little more dramatic?
It is. Cortina, so Bormio is a village that has existed for 2,000 years. So they have an old town, Bormio, which truly is an old town, in the sense that, you know, that's been around for 2,000 years. So it's not expressly geared to like the ski sort of destination sort of visitor, whereas Cortina, which was a small village, really evolved as it became a ski destination. And that really was triggered when the 1956 Olympics were here in the years leading up to that. So it's a much different feel in Cortina. And the one big difference is yesterday in Cortina was the women's Super G race. And Frederica Brignone, an Italian skier who wasn't expected to race in this games, ended up winning the gold medal yesterday. So that set Cortina on fire yesterday afternoon and evening. The main street, which is all pedestrian, was jam-packed. People were celebrating. It was a very festive atmosphere. It was really amazing to see. And that's the kind of energy that you'd like to see 24/7 at the Olympics. You know, I did not eat dinner out last night because I spent some time just walking Main Street and just had a protein bar. But I'm going to be in Cortina in the village tonight for dinner, and I'll see what sort of, you know, after event activities are going on. At Bormio, it was very quiet. They did have a main plaza that was set up for like Olympic festivities, but you know, it wasn't very activated. And that's something that I want us to focus on, because I want these games to be great. You know, when we have them in parks in Utah in 2034 and the venues that we're hosting in Park City, I want those to be amazing competitions. I want the athletes to have an amazing experience, but I want the fans to have an amazing experience watching the competitions and then afterwards. You know, so the athletes will be competing during the events, and we'll be competing for the spectators' attention after the events.
So let's talk a little bit about it. I know obviously part of why you're there as a city councilman is in the years to come to plan for our 34 games. So were you able to meet with anyone or otherwise able to get a sense of the behind-the-scenes work that the Italians did to prepare the games, particularly in Cortina?
You know, so most of those folks are extremely, extremely busy right now. And even if you had 15 minutes to sit down and talk to them, they would need 15 days to kind of tell you the whole story. So for me, I, and my plan was to come in and experience this like a visitor to the games, get on the app, download the app, figure out how to, you know, get from place to place. Now, I flew in the closer airport in Milan, the closer to the city airport, which is convenient, served by train, into the central station in Milan, and you can get just about anywhere. And I intended to take the public transit option to get up to Bormio on Monday evening. But after I landed, I looked at the schedule, and there was only one more departure left that would take me to the midway point, which is a city called Toronto, where you get off the train ends and you have to get on a bus. And it wasn't clear that I'd make it up there in time to make the last bus into Bormio. And that whole travel time, you know, mapped out to be 6.5 hours. Whereas I had a rental car reservation that I ended up opting into, not canceling. And I drove myself up Monday evening in about 2 hours and 20 minutes. And there was nobody on the road. And that kind of speaks to this spread out nature of this games. You know, it's really kind of dispersed sort of traffic flow, and they've restricted traffic into the venue cities themselves. So there was you weren't allowed to drive into Bormio during the day. I came in at late at night, so I was able to get in.
But yeah, but it also speaks to that lesson we've learned here, which is public transportation works when it is accessible, convenient, and understandable.
Absolutely. And, you know, the one other big difference, Roger, is like, so when I went to leave Bormio to head over to Cortina, because the men's alpine events are in Bormio, the women's alpine events are in Cortina, I put it into Apple Maps, and it said 6 hours and 20 minutes. And I said, oh, my God. And it's only I believe it was only about 180 kilometers. And don't quote me, but I think that's about 110 miles or so. But most of it, all of it except for 25 miles, was on two-lane windy roads, switchbacks, hairpin turns, winding through little villages where the road was about 14 feet wide for both lanes. And you know, so we have a leg up in that our games are more compact, our footprint is more compact, and I hope our organizing committee really leans into that. and maybe even, you know, looks to consolidate it a little bit from where it was in 2002, because it really makes for a better spectator experience, and it really brings the Olympic spirit. You're then rubbing elbows with people from every, you know, country in the world, and it's just amazing.
Well, so looking at it from that perspective, what do you think, in terms of the fan experience, what do you think they've done best? What stands out to you as, particularly when you compare it with Paris, what do you think they've done well? What have they learned that we can learn from?
Yeah, you know, it's that's a difficult question to answer four days in for me. Mm-hmm. I'll definitely have a takeaway on that a week or so from now. I'll be here till February 22nd. And my last four days, four nights will be in Milan. You know, what I would say is I think what the Italians had going for them, Roger, is the things that they do best, which is the way they live, the way they, you know, share joy, the way they love to share their culture, their traditions, you know, be it food, art, fashion, all that stuff. It really, I mean, this is a wonderful place to host an event like the Olympics for all those reasons. And I think that many of the folks that are visiting will have that kind of takeaway.
Is there anything that you've seen that you went, you know what, we're not going to do it that way, that struck you as things that they could have done better that are correctable?
The biggest thing for me, and we've touched on this earlier in this interview, is they separated the men's and women's alpine events, and they're 6.5 hours apart. There's no way to get between those two places any faster. And so on Tuesday, the men's Super G was in Bormio. You can't, like, if there was an event the next day in Cortina, women's event, you can't get there fast enough. There's like, you can't get there for the next day to watch that event. So I think that's been a frustration for some folks. Now, Livigno, the venue where they have the freestyle events, I didn't get up there, but I was told that by folks who had been there, that was a big party atmosphere, which makes sense. It's the freestyle events. So, you know, look, we have those in Park City in 2034. So we need to leverage off of that energy across all of the venue and all the events that we host in Park City, as well as Main Street and the surrounding areas.
Now, we've touched a little bit on this, but I know it's an issue that's very close to your heart, which is, let's talk about transportation and parking in some of the areas where the competitions are actually being held. How have they handled that, and anything you've learned from there that you think will be valuable for us?
So they've set up sort of remote parking destinations that are probably on average somewhere maybe about an hour by bus outside of the main venue cities. It could be 40 minutes, could be an hour, maybe a little bit more, just depends. If you're coming into a venue city for the day, you park at this remote parking location, then you get on a bus and take the bus in. They don't let people drive past that point into the venue cities unless you have a special permission sticker in your window. And that's worked. I mean, it's worked very well for them. You know, Bormio was, they restricted traffic in, but there's some local traffic. People, if you're staying in a hotel, you can get a pass in your car. But nobody was driving. Everybody was walking. And it was really fantastic. Like, you know, I walked for an hour and a half on Tuesday evening before dinner, and then another half hour after dinner, just walking around, and it was comfortable. You could cross streets, you didn't have to worry about getting plowed over, didn't have to wait for lights. So that was fantastic. And Cortina is much the same. It's largely car free right now, and it really is enjoyable. And that's something, you know, look, we did that in 2002 on Main Street. I think if we do that again, I think we should do it again. And I think if we do, we're going to have a really tremendous atmosphere on Main Street, and it's really going to be fantastic. And hopefully if the two Italian policemen that asked me for if I had any pins on Tuesday in Bormio, hopefully they're in Salt Lake in Utah in 2034, because I'll have pins for them then. I was pinless at that moment.
All right, Bill, do you come back with a renewed sense of urgency with respect to elements of preparation for us for 2034?
100%, Roger. And look, there's a couple different buckets here. There are things that we need to do specifically for the Olympics. Much of that will be driven by the timeline and schedules of the organizing committee. There are things that we need to do in Park City that will serve us well in the Olympics, but we need to do them regardless. And those are things that we need to lead the charge on, and we need to be out in front from a timeline perspective. And then there's just private development that happens. And, you know, in Bormio, which is not a booming town, I mean, I counted from my hotel room 7 or 8 cranes. You know, it's very close quarters, not big pieces of property. Like, homes are right up and buildings are right next to each other. So typically you have a crane when you're doing construction. There were 7 or 8 of those. I didn't get a good look in Cortina, but I was here last March and I counted like 15 cranes. I didn't see many today. So they did a good job of wrapping a lot of that stuff up. But, you know, we need to make sure that our processes at City Hall in terms of permitting and planning and expediting stuff is running smoothly so that the private work can get done as well.
Okay, Bill, I know you're going to see some games because you're going to be there for another week. What have you seen so far that you loved and what are you most looking forward to?
So I saw the men's Super G and the women's Super G, both alpine ski races. Those are my favorite stuff is the alpine ski racing. In Cortina, they have the sliding center as well as the curling stadium. So I'm going to head over. I think there's a curling event tonight. It'll be my first time seeing curling in person. I mean, I think I've watched it a little bit once or twice on TV, and the curling fans are quite energetic. So I'm looking forward to that tonight.
All right. Councilman Bill Scirocco, I will have more questions for you in our next Friday council debrief about what you've learned from these Olympics after you've had another week. Meanwhile, enjoy the rest of the games, and thanks for joining me this morning.
Fantastic. Thank you, Roger.
All right. Wasatch County Council members have several concerns about the proposed Heber Valley Bypass, including how wetlands will be preserved and how traffic patterns will change. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports they're sending a letter to UDOT.
The Utah Department of Transportation announced in January it intends to construct the Heber Valley Bypass through part of the North Fields. UDOT officials say they've already received more than 200 comments about the draft environmental impact statement, and elected officials are adding their voices to the conversation. The Heber City Council drafted a letter to UDOT February 3rd with a list of several concerns about the route. The Wasatch County Council discussed a similar letter Wednesday. The council's concerns include maintenance of the frontage road planned for North US 40, gaps in the regional trail network, areas where the bypass is only one lane in each direction, and wetland mitigation. A couple of issues overlapped with those raised by the Heber City Council, including bypass access via Southfield Road and trail safety along Midway Lane. Some county council members wanted to ensure wetland mitigation does not inadvertently interfere with farming in the North Fields. Spencer Park said local farmers' deep knowledge of the land and the seasonal runoff is imperative to the field's long-term health.
They know how to do it. They've been doing it for generations. And I worry long-term, will you really have wetlands if there's not somebody knowledgeable,
active,
willingly pushing the runoff water there?
UDOT has promised to conserve at least 2 acres of wetlands for every acre affected by the highway. Heidi Franco attended Wednesday's meeting to speak with the council. She's the mayor of Heber City and the chair of the Wasatch Open Lands Board. Despite UDOT's promise that no additional access points will be allowed for the bypass, Franco said she's worried about future growth.
The developer pressure is exceedingly real. I can tell you that very much so. We're constantly being contacted by all kinds of developers about all kinds of areas to be annexed or upzoned. So that is going to continue.
County leaders had mixed reactions to the draft EIS. Councilmember Eric Rowland is concerned about preserving Wasatch County's rural heritage and said he'd like to see a compromise between UDOT's choice and the county's values.
UDOT's given their opinion that they think it's B. Why can't we give our opinion as far as we think? And I understand that there's experts, but there's also things that we hold very strongly and sacred in this valley. And that's probably worth consideration.
On the other hand, Councilmember Mark Nelson said, although he doesn't like UDOT's choice, he thinks the county needs to trust the agency's expertise and try to collaborate.
We knew we weren't going to like it. I think that at the end of the day, we need to accept their recommendation and do our very best.
Council members decided to discuss their ideas for another week and then share more feedback with UDOT. UDOT Project Manager Craig Hancock said the agency is reviewing public comments and developing an FAQ page to respond to residents' most common concerns. Locals have until March 9th to comment on the bypass route. UDOT will group comments into categories and respond to them in the final EIS, which will be published this summer. To read the draft EIS, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, for the second time in recent years, all eyes in the legal media world are likely to be focused on Park City due to the Corey Richens trial. This is going to go beyond the Gwyneth Paltrow trial in terms of the kinds of media and the kind of coverage we're going to expect. Joining me in the studio, the trial will start on February 23rd. Joining me in the studio to talk about what happened this week and what to expect in the weeks to come is our own Connor Thomas. Morning, Connor. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Roger. Good morning.
So, Connor, let's do a little bit of background for those who have not been following it as closely as you and I have. What are the basic facts surrounding the Richens case?
Yeah, so this centers around events 4 years ago, and it will be interesting to see that the, you could say, anniversary of the death of Eric Richens will pass mid-trial, March 4th, 2022. He's a Francis resident at the time, died of a fentanyl overdose, and his wife, Corey Richens, called it in, but 1 year later was arrested on suspicion of his murder, charged with that, as well as attempted murder, a host of financial and fraud-related crimes that we can get into later. But she was arrested after having written a book about grief, a children's book, that she came on local news hour to promo about a month before her arrest. And this obviously has captured a lot of media and public attention since, to the point of international media coverage. And that's certainly been this side story as we've covered the facts of the case and the proceedings in court leading up to trial, the delayed now on and scheduled trial. And it's been interesting to watch just the amount of media at the local Silver Summit courthouse.
So when you were there this week for jury selection, were you already seeing lots of media presence?
I'm seeing the preparations for it. I also covered that Gwyneth Paltrow civil trial, as you mentioned. And one thing that struck me is the level of preparation on the court side appears to exceed that. Obviously, there were lots of public, but there wasn't ever a full court in the sense that folks couldn't get in or there wasn't like a queue outside, but they're already talking about lines and you just get the sense that there's something about this trial that may capture people's attention a little bit more.
So this week we had the voir dire or jury selection process. Before we get to that, what are your sort of observations about the lawyers on each side? Who's representing the defendant and who's taking the ball for the county?
Well, obviously the prosecutors, it's the Summit County Attorney's Office, and you know, the chief prosecutor now is Brad Bloodworth, and he's been doing a lot of the arguing in court, but they've really got all their attorneys in court at the beginning of each day there on the prosecutor's side, and the defense's side isn't much smaller. Kathy Nestor and Wendy Lewis are the former federal defense attorneys, now public defenders appointed by the state since Richens' original attorneys from Ray Quinney withdrew from the case, probably two years ago now. So you've got these, both sides seem to have good lawyers. And it's worth noting that Kathy Nestor, at least, is also on the Tyler Robinson defense team. Utah, of course, now having an arguably even higher profile alleged murder trial over there in Utah County since the killing of Charlie Kirk.
And talk a little bit about how the voir dire process went. Was it, I think it was expected to take longer than it did. How many jurors have now been seated?
Roger, I expected to be in court this morning right now. This was supposed to go until, or scheduled to go until next Wednesday, skipping President's Day. They finished it after one day of in-person questionings. I think it'd be helpful for people to know what voir dire is.
Everyone, I'm sorry, in Utah sometimes, says, sometimes I speak lawyer.
And I'd be interested if you've heard this. Everyone in Utah says voir dire. not voir dire, but it French for speak the truth, and it's in-person questioning of potential jurors to ferret out those that maybe couldn't be impartial, those that may be too familiar with the case, and essentially try to impanel a jury of peers to try the case fairly in accordance, you know, with the defendant's constitutional rights.
So they go through a process where they're allowed to ask questions to determine whether a potential juror should be struck for cause, and they also have a certain number that they can just do called peremptories, where they can just choose to strike somebody. Talk to us a little bit about some of the reasons that we saw that jurors were struck for cause in this case.
I like starting with things that are not the case, and that may or may not be helpful for people. They didn't strike people who had heard of the case simply for having heard of the case. They did send out close to 2,000 written jury questionnaires before voir dire this week, and they definitely struck people who had said they followed it closely. But even somewhat closely, those jurors were brought in for in-person questioning. And so the defense especially had a lot of questions about where they get their news, what they've heard about the case. In the intervening period between turning in their jury questionnaire and coming in for in-person questioning, did they see any other news about the case, and what have they heard? Prosecutors, for their part, asked a lot of fairly standard questions about, you know, what potential jurors' attitudes toward law enforcement and state prosecutors in general are. The defense, again, appeared to, at least for the part of voir dire that I saw, asked the most questions, and they were very curious if folks had said they watched or enjoyed true crime content, and what their opinions about that were. Obviously, we've already had a Dateline and 48 Hours episode about this case, and I expect more after the conclusion of the trial. So this is something that will become true crime fodder, and that seems like something the defense is interested in the minds of potential jurors.
Okay, so they seated 12, eight regulars and four alternates?
Eight regulars, four alternates, of the 12. You've got half and half men and women. You know, they talk a little bit about their work experience, and prosecutors said during the questioning this week that they were looking for people relatively well-educated and with good business or higher levels of business experience, partly because of the motive aspects of this case. We expect them, in proving motive for murder, to look at Corey Richens' financial situation, and she was in the realty business and made money flipping houses, things like this, but it is prosecutors' belief that she was in the red. And so they're gonna have lots of these financial exhibits, or we expect, based on what they've said so far, and likely want a higher level of education for folks to not be overwhelmed by exhibits like that. We can get into some of the contentious aspects of the jury selection process in a moment, but some of the folks they did seat have real estate licenses or experience, and so it's interesting to see.
I was going to say, this is Summit County. One might argue that it would be hard to find a representative jury that didn't have at least one realtor in it.
Oh, yeah. relatively disproportionately well-educated, affluent demographics here, for sure. One thing that they were really trying to get to in questions were, is this juror going to turn into a subject matter expert in the jury room? That's something they don't want. You're supposed to just look at the evidence presented in the room and draw conclusions based on your mental faculties, but not on your prior like work experience of your opinion of, is this witness the type of person I would think is credible when I was at work? It's, mm-hmm. you're supposed to suspend some of those things and really adopt the role of juror and not of, say, whoever you are professionally.
Now, you sort of touched a little bit on some of the prosecution theories that we expect, right, which is financial gain and sort of painting that picture. From what you've seen in the various arguments leading up to where we are now, what do you anticipate the defense theory is going to be?
You know, there's been some haggling. We don't know really at all or very much about what evidence will or will not be admissible. And we don't want to get ahead of ourselves before stuff is discussed at trial. Yes.
There have been some what they call motions in limine, which is where different sides try to come in and say, you can't introduce this or you can't introduce that. But you haven't been able to see those, have you?
No, a lot of them most of them have been sealed. All of them have been sealed, right? And a lot were ruled on in closed court just because of the extraordinary level of media attention. But it can see the titles. And one of the titles of the motions in limine were, it was a motion regarding evidence, and evidence does not mean it's true. That's just the word for the type of information that will be presented, that the victim abused drugs in high school. And so there will be discussion of other, the defense is expected to try and offer alternative theories about how the alleged murder weapon is fentanyl, how that substance could have made it into Eric Richin's system, other than the way prosecutors say, which is that his wife orally gave it to him.
Okay. You mentioned there was some contention during the jury selection process.
Yeah, there was a Batson objection.
You learned what a Batson objection is.
It was interesting to watch. That's where, if you're a member of a protected class and you're struck by, well, maybe it'd be helpful to explain peremptory strikes. Usually in Utah for felony cases, each side, prosecutors and defense, get to toss out four jurors each for any number of reasons. You don't even need to tell the court your reasons, usually. For capital cases, it's 10, and in this case, the defense motioned to get 10, but death penalty is off the table, has been off the table for years in this case, and so the judge denied that motion, but has allowed the sides at least six peremptory strikes in this case. One of the prosecution's strikes was of the jurors they talked to on Tuesday, the only Latino juror in the pool, at least presenting. That's what the defense thought, and they objected. They thought that was based on race. The judge ruled that they didn't make that prima facie case and allowed the juror to be released and excused from service. But it was interesting because that is certainly an appellate issue. Once this case is over, all the parties have been talking as if this thing will get appealed, and the stakes are so high that I think that makes sense. And I think it's worth noting, usually appellate courts aren't looking at all the facts again, retrying the case, calling all the witnesses. They're more reviewing the procedures of the lower court to see if they arrived at their conclusion using the correct reasoning, and they did everything by the book. To create an appellate record for a court to look at, the judge did go through this three-step Batson process and asked prosecutors to proffer some race-neutral reasons why they might have struck this juror, and allowed defense to respond, but this is all after he allowed the juror to be released anyway. But that was where we learned kind of about prosecutors were looking for, say they're looking for in jurors, that business experience. There was also some discussion of the length of this trial. They need jurors who can skip work for 5 weeks, which not a lot of us can do, but they were able to find people that they're confident their work has policies of paying them for jury service or partially. But it's worth noting, this is going to be an uncommonly long trial, February 23rd to March 27th now.
And that does segue into what I wanted to ask you, which is expect to last about 5 weeks. Connor, what's our plan here at KPCW to cover the trial?
Well, my plan's to be there every day. We'll see how seating works. Again, courtroom B in Silver Summit is not the largest room in the world. But for those that don't want to go over there and mess with the circus that will likely ensue outside, media have been granted permission to live stream this. So we'll have a YouTube link embedded in web stories online at kpcw.org for folks that are interested in tuning in for opening, closing, any particular witness testimony. But on important days, the plan is to give pretty regular updates on our website, and then, of course, stories throughout the trial so folks know what's going on.
And 2 weeks from now, Connor, you and I are going to have an expert in the here on Local News Hour. We'll be looking at the openings, assuming everything goes on time. 2 weeks from now, we'll be sort of reviewing the opening statements and trying to get a former prosecutor's perspective on what each side was trying to achieve and how well she thinks they did it.
Yeah, assuming it all goes on time. Of course, this has been delayed once before just because of all the motions ahead of trial. So the schedule right now is February 23rd, goes to for 5 weeks. We was extended one day two days ago, to March 27th. And so it looks like there's already some behind-the-scenes discussion of, do we have enough time? The judge has so far not extended it a sixth week.
All right, Connor. Thanks for coming in this morning, and we'll all be looking forward to your coverage of this important trial.
Thank you.
The Wasatch County Republican Party had an emergency meeting Wednesday after the arrest of its chairperson. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the party's vice chair will temporarily lead the group.
Wasatch County GOP Chair David Nephi Johnson was charged with felony child abuse Wednesday after allegedly holding a 16-year-old relative under running water, preventing the teenager from breathing. Johnson, who's 54, was elected chair of the Wasatch County Republican Party in May 2025. In a statement Wednesday, party leaders said they are deeply concerned and troubled by the nature of the allegations. The executive committee decided in an emergency meeting that Vice Chair Patty Sprunt would temporarily take over Johnson's responsibilities as chair. The statement said the party trusts Heber City Police and the legal system to thoroughly investigate the abuse allegations. It also encouraged locals to refrain from judgment until the case is adjudicated. The party leaders said they remain focused on serving Wasatch County voters and that their thoughts are with the Johnson family. Johnson is set to appear in 4th District Court for a preliminary hearing March 11th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Byrne Family Foundation recently awarded one of its fast-track grants to PC Gardens / Eats. Here to tell us about the foundation and its innovative Fast Tracks program are Heather Koopman of the foundation and Helen Nadel of PC Gardens Eats. Good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. We're actually going to see some snow, it looks like. So that should be a change for us, and hopefully it's good for the industry and maybe good for the gardens as well. Okay, Heather, can you share a bit about the history of the foundation and the way it defines its mission?
Sure. So we are a family foundation that supports education and animal welfare in both Park City as well as Dallas, Texas, which is where the family lives. I'm both the director of the foundation as well as a member of the family. So our Fast Track grants we created to fill a gap that many nonprofits face when they have unexpected challenges that would arise outside of traditional grant cycles. So we knew the grant funding could be slow and grant applications could be time consuming. And nonprofits don't always have discretionary funds to address emergencies. So Fast Track was our answer to that gap.
So I have to ask you, why the dichotomy Dallas-Park City? I mean, that's not all that uncommon, a ski family second house arrangement, but it's not necessarily typical of a grant program like this.
Right, so the foundation is based in Dallas, but I live in Park City. So
that answers the question.
Idea was that it's where board members reside.
And how long have you, do you have sort of similar operations in Dallas where you're giving out grants to Dallas area causes?
Yes.
Okay. And
the majority of our giving is Dallas, but we do Park City giving as well.
And what, talk a little bit more about sort of the typical size of the award. I can stammer a little more, or I can just stop and ask you the question.
So the grants could be up to $10,000. Our average size is $5,000. They are, like I said, quick emergency response grants. It's a fast application. I think it's about 2 or 3 hours to complete. Funds are awarded within 4 weeks of applying, and it's open quarterly.
Okay, so every quarter you sort of issue a series of these. Do you have like a fixed amount you're shooting to try to approximately give out every quarter?
We have a $300,000 budget for all four cycles, okay. So about $75,000 per cycle.
One of the things that always interests me in these kinds of grant programs, how closely are you tying these grants to a specific identified need? A project. In other words, do people come in and say, I have this specific problem for my nonprofit?
I mean, to qualify for this, it has to be a time-sensitive need. You have to show the urgency. It can't just be an urgent mission. It needs to be an urgent need. So this is our only open grant program. So if you're a nonprofit in Park City or Summit County and you work in education or animal welfare, you know, definitely apply if you have that time-sensitive need.
And do you do any kind of follow-up after the fact to say, okay, how did this project work out?
Yeah, we have one report at 6 months that's just 6 questions, so pretty simple. We run it through our grant portal, which is submittable. So we try to make it as user-friendly as we can.
Okay. And about how many of these sort of fast-track grants have you sort of given out since you started the program? Order of magnitude, you know.
Probably about 150.
So it's a very, very large program. This actually sounds like this kind of a project. I mean, I have sat on a similar sort of grant program for the local Rotary Club, and I know how much time it takes. So I'm thinking about, you know, do you have professional staff that help you, or is it really your board members who are reviewing?
Yeah, I read the grants, and then I have consultant that helps me read the grants as well. We've gotten pretty good at it. We can be pretty quick. But we are really excited that we hit this major milestone, which was $1 million in fast track giving since we launched the program in 2022.
And that's sort of, I guess that's one of the reasons you're here this morning, is
right.
Because that $1 million is a significant milestone. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the organizations that have received the grants, but let me ask this just so people can get a fuller sense of the overall program. You also have, do you also have another types of grants that you give outside of the Fast Track program?
Right. We have a one-year grant program that just opened yesterday. That's for, it's invite only for project or program specific needs. And then we have a multi-year grant that opens in September, and that's general operating funding.
Okay, so these are very different kinds of needs,
right?
And so it makes a lot of sense to me that you would run different programs. But boy, that's a lot of grant reading that you get to do, isn't it?
It is.
You must enjoy it. Okay, talk to us about some of the organizations that have received Fast Track grants in the past.
Yeah, well, I would say that Summit Community Gardens is a perfect example of how Fast Track works, and how we believe responsive grant-making support can help grow into deeper partnerships.
So let's talk about I always have trouble sort of blending the two names together ever since you guys merged.
We are Summit Community Gardens and Eats. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Are you ever going to just adopt one single name?
You know, that's a great question, Roger. And I'll just say not the first time I've been asked
I'm
that.
I'm not surprised.
So we are actually going to be engaging in a strategic planning process, and which will probably end in a rebrand in 2026, 2027. So it's a mouthful, but I will say.
I think you should have a contest to name that organization.
Well, you know, thank you. Yeah, we'll run it through KPCW.
And require a donation if you want to make a name, you have to give a certain amount of money anyway. So you are going to do a rebranding. All right, so tell us a little, for those who are not as familiar with that organization, tell us a little about the two organizations and how they came together.
Sure, yeah. Summit Community Gardens and Eats our merger happened, almost 4 years ago now. And we are really focused on food education, food access, and having a place to steward. We run the community garden that is the only public community garden in Summit County. And so stewarding that land, both for the 120 plus plot holders who community garden there, but also as a place for to really build soil, to improve the land itself. We take that really seriously, and it's also a place where just people come together. We have a wonderful snacking garden where anybody can come anytime during the season and grab some delicious food right off the vine. We have dinners in the garden on lots of volunteerism for people to get involved with. And but I would say that for the with our our relationship with Byrne Family Foundation really focuses on our education work. So overall, the nonprofit sees about 4,000 people during any given year, and about 2,000 of those are children that we are really working with to connect young people to how food grows, to cooking, nutrition, and to lifelong healthy eating habits. And I think it's been amazing to have the support through some of the Fast Track grant programs as our initial kind of connection with the foundation, and to now be we've been invited to do a 1 year programmatic grant.
So let's talk about if you can remember, what was the first Fast Track grant and what was the project?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2023, we had been running a program for a while, which was a food access program for our school children in Park City. So we provide fresh fruit as a way for kids who are free and reduced lunch eligible to have a healthy snack, just like their peers might. It's not something that is offered through that program, and so we just recognized that need. When the emergency allotments for SNAP were ending in 2023, what we realized was that the intense need for food and the food insecurity that does exist in our community, those were not going away and had really intensified. And so rather than delivering food every other week to kids in schools, we wanted to deliver it every week because we just saw there was an emergency need that needed to be fulfilled right away. And we were able to, because of that, again, that food insecurity is an ongoing need in our community, right? There's, I think, 9% of kids, of families are in our whole county are at the federal poverty level, and about 17% of kids, used to be 19% of kids are free and reduced lunch eligible. So we know that that need exists, and it's a need that desperately needs to be filled even now. At that moment, though, we knew that because of the SNAP allotments being, you know, ending, that kids were going to be hungry during the school day, and they really needed healthy snacks. So we turned to the Byrne Family Foundation Fast Track program to see if they could help us meet that immediate need.
So mechanically, how did that work? Do you have to get into an arrangement with the school system to be able to provide it?
Do you mean like in terms of how that program works?
How does the food get to the kids?
Yeah, we work with the school outreach coordinators, and I'll say this is a program. This is a program that still exists today and has expanded. It's a perfect example of the way that the Byrne Family Foundation had. There was an unmet need that was immediate. They helped us to fill it. And now that program is completely stable. It's expanded. We work with the school outreach coordinators in every Park City school, plus Holy Cross Ministries. We deliver fruit every week to the schools. The school outreach coordinators are really our key facilitators because they are, although we do a ton of education in the schools, they are really much more aligned with the families that are really experiencing food insecurity and need some help.
Okay. For people who are listening and want to learn more about, first of all, about PC, about Eats, where would they look?
Yeah, so our website is summitcommunitygardens.org, and there's lots of information about all the programming that we do, food access, food education in the schools, as well as, you know, throughout the community.
And Heather, if a not-for-profit is listening to this and thinks they might be the right fit for one of your grants, where would they look?
Yes, our next Fast Track grant program is open April 20th through the 24th, and so you could go to our website now, which is ByrneFamilyFoundationTrust.org. Sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss that opening. Otherwise, the grants cycle opens on the 20th and closes at 5 p.m. on the 24th.
Okay. Heather Koopman of the Byrne Family Foundation and Helen Nadel of PC Gardens Eats. Thanks for spending time with me this morning.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Coming up right after the NPR News on the Community Campfire, they're going to merge Valentine's Day with the Olympics and hear from two couples who fell in love at the Olympics years ago. Then Coach Skinner will have the skinny on sports, and the band, The Last Wild Buffalo, will join for an in-studio performance.